I'm pleased to welcome to View from the Roundhouse Professor Martin Drum from University of Notre Dame. Where are you today, Martin? Is it Nuremberg, Savannah, Broome, or is it possibly even Fremantle?
No, I'm on leave at the moment, so I'm here in sunny Gilderton, the small regional town about an hour north of Perth. Michael, lovely place to be.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, because you probably haven't heard what's going on in this sad, sorry world of ours, Martin. It's in short, as the readers will and listeners will see when they bring the podcast up: Gaza, Manchester, Russia, PNG, nuclear power, the 5% policy, the US shutdown. I suppose we could just go to a Gilderton and close our ears to these things. But yesterday, overnight sort of thing, we have this terrible anti-Semitic hate crime committed in Manchester, England. Man in his car with what looks like a non-functioning or fake belt of explosives around him, but goes stabbing, driving his car into people. And it all timed with what's going on in Gaza, I suppose you might say. You can't imagine for a minute that the act of this madman is likely to be productive, if anything, anti-productive to resolving things in the world. But can I just get you to pause for a moment, go back to the beginning of the week, which has almost been lost in the mist of time, with President Trump's Gaza plan, Middle East solution plan. What did you make of it?
Well, I think that the peace plan, firstly, any peace plan that stops the fighting in the short term is a good thing. So even if it doesn't end up delivering an overall long-term peace solution, a ceasefire itself is valuable for all concerned, especially the people, ordinary civilians in Gaza, for what they've been through. So I think we should be pleased about that. There is hope over the 20 points of the plan. There is a pathway there. The thing about a peace plan is you can't judge it until you're well down the track, maybe years down the track, to see whether it's been effective in the long term. There's 20 different steps along the way. But even if they just achieve the first two or three and stop the fighting for now, that's a step forward. Trump's got Netanyahu to agree to it. I guess the question is whether Hamas agrees to it. Hamas doesn't really have that many choices left. So they're being pressured by their few remaining international contacts, Qatar, Egypt, Turkey, etc. They're the ones that continue to have relations with them. They're being pressed by them to accept it. Iran's position is interesting here. They've said nothing about this deal, so-called deal. But I suspect that they'll be quabbling over the details. There are some contentious elements here between the parties, but I think at least if the ceasefire holds for now, that would be a step forward.
I can't help but think of a bad B-grade Western movie in all of this, Martin, where the baddie, all his mates having been shot, is left inside the building. The cavalry have turned up. There's 20 or 30 of them, snipers all aiming at the front door and the windows and the chimney on top in case he comes out there, and they demand that he give up, that he surrender, that he come out. And he thinks to himself inside, well, it doesn't matter what I do. If I come out with a white flag in my arms, I know I'm going to be shot. So I might as well fight the bastards to the end. Do you think there's a little bit of that with the Hamas group?
There is something of that. They've got not much more left to lose, but there would be some people in Gaza. There would be plenty of people in Gaza that want peace, and some of them would be putting subtle pressure on Hamas operatives in Gaza. You'd expect there. The irony is, from what we hear, this is what we hear, is that the political leaders in Qatar are generally more willing to make peace than the military leaders in Gaza. And that's just extraordinary. The people in, maybe it's due to what you're thinking. If you're in Gaza, if you're a Hamas member, you've got nothing to lose. If you're sitting in a comfortable house in Qatar as one of the political leaders, then maybe you do want the organisation to continue in some form. So, how do they reconcile those differences? A lot of the leadership of Gaza has been wiped out, Hamas leadership. There's some discussion around the remaining leadership and what they think. I think they'd be crazy not to accept this, just for the sake of their people. That's the people. That's who the rest of us are thinking about here when it comes to peace. But yeah, it does speak to what you're saying there. Maybe they think they've got nothing left to lose.
Well, I suppose the answer to the question, it's too soon, is it, to say that the Trump Gaza plan has failed? Is that, yes, it's just too soon.
Oh, I think it's too soon to say it's failed or succeeded. We haven't got a response back from Hamas yet. If Hamas doesn't accept it, then clearly it's not got off the ground. Even if Hamas accepts it, then you may get a temporary cessation of hostilities, and then they'll be arguing over what happens next. And there might be, as we often see, Michael, each side accusing the other of breaking the ceasefire and breaking its terms and things like that. That might well be the case. That eventuates. That wouldn't surprise me. There's absolutely no inclination from these two entities to agree on anything at the moment. The level of hate between them is extraordinary.
The level of hate, as I opened with Martin, for some people, like this British citizen with a Syrian ethnic background who's driven his car and stabbed people, two dead in Manchester. For me at least, it's very difficult to take on board. One assumes, with what's going on in Gaza and the state of the world there, that that it's some sort of action connected with it. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's just a plain old anti-Semitic act that could have happened anytime, anywhere, but you wouldn't have thought it would help the cause of Hamas.
No, it doesn't help the cause of anyone, really. I think it just makes matters worse. I mean, it's an awful act. Political violence in all of its forms is unacceptable, and Jewish people should be able to go about their everyday life in Britain in peace. And you talked about being counterproductive, Michael. It feeds into this perception of Middle Eastern migrants as dangerous. And there'll be the usual far right that will capitalize on this. They'll say, I told you so. And there are many, many people from the Middle East and UK that are living very productive lives. So it doesn't help them at all. It doesn't help anyone. It doesn't help the cause of Hamas at all. So it's an awful act that just has negative consequences.
It is simply terrible, and you realise that we do live in a global village, even though some people want to not think that way. Something like that happens, we all know about it immediately. Everything happens so quickly around the world, and of course, it'll make the security agencies in Australia be on their toes as well. It's a terrible thing. Changing the topic, though, Martin, for a long time, Australia was the colonial ruler of Papua New Guinea. But yesterday we've had the long promised agreement between PNG and Australia. It's a bit more interesting than I thought it was going to be. Can you tell our listeners what's in it, and is it significant?
I think it's significant, certainly. So this is Australia and the PNG, Australia and Papua New Guinea, our northern neighbour, actually the closest country to Australia, just to our north, engage signing an agreement to fuse their armed forces in some ways. I mean, it's not quite that, but it's almost that. It's because PNG citizens can enrol in our armed forces and vice versa. And it's got a NATO-like impact in that it expects us to come to their aid and defend PNG against threats. So it's a really significant agreement between the two nations. It does extend our direct defence capacity expectations north of our current borders. It's not without some contention, Michael, because you don't have to go back too far to find PNG engaging in military activities in the island of Bougainville, which was deeply contentious. And what would the commitment of Australia be under such circumstances? Would we be obliged to join in those activities or acquiesce in certain forms in those activities given this agreement? That was said to be the reason why no agreement was pursued with PNG in an earlier stage, Bougainville crisis has somewhat melted away for a variety of reasons. But they're all issues. Governance in PNG, Michael, has not always been smooth, transparent, and straightforward over the years.
Well, I suppose there'll be all sorts of caveats, conditions, the lay of the land when we come in to help, written into this agreement, whether or not we get to see the fine print.
I think that's a good point. It would be interesting to see what the devil in the detail is. Does it give us out clauses in a range of scenarios where we don't think it's appropriate to support the PNG army?
So far as its significance is concerned, I suppose there's the very direct one between PNG and us and everything you've just mentioned. But in the wider Pacific Islands context, there must be some suggestions that this is a model for what can be agreed with other countries in the region.
Well, I mean, the biggest thing is you've got all these Pacific islands, some of which are closer to Australia and New Zealand, and some of which are closer to China. Of course, the US is a player in the broader scheme of things as well. And this is definitely a move by Australia to sew up PNG up in this respect. China is a major investor in PNG. So they would be quite unhappy about this development. So it does feed into strategic implications for the whole region.
I was in Vanuatu on one occasion, and you really did feel the presence of Australia and New Zealand there as close, nearby, friendly neighbours. It strikes me that Vanuatu might be the next cab off the rank when it comes to signing an agreement.
Well, I think there'd be a range of other nations that would be eyeing off something similar, and Mount Palau being another one, etc. So, it would be really interesting to see if it creates a bit of a domino effect.
Martin, keeping with the theme that we still do live in a global village, we learnt very quickly that with the EU group getting together, the Danish PM was warning about Russia and that they sort of won't stop until they're made to. Would those comments by the Danish PM, a relatively young woman, take anyone by surprise?
They're not new or different in that European powers have been expressing concern about Russia for some time, of course. But they were very strident. This is Danish PM, Prime Minister, saying that their country, she felt their country was directly under threat from Russia. They're not bordering Russia at the moment. So it is quite interesting. There's a ramping up of rhetoric of late, probably last month or two, from European powers. It's based around Russian planes going into airspace for other countries, such as Poland, and the presence of drones on other territory as well. Russia's denied these allegations that they're encroaching on airspace of other countries, but there's fairly, consistent evidence of this occurring. And who else would it be sending drones, foreign drones, across these areas, Michael? So it's probably. Again, it feeds into fears that this conflict between Russia and Ukraine could spread and could have implications for Europe more broadly.
It's very easy, isn't it? Like kids in the playground egging each other on, and you know that someone's going to throw a fist, and you don't know what will happen after that. We see it on football fields sometimes. Other players come in and push the protagonists apart. Sometimes they all hop in. There's a danger here, Martin, or is it too alarmist to say that?
Well, I don't think it's, I know we've discussed this before. I think there's a possibility. I think it's still low at the moment, but there is a possibility that the conflict could spread. And certainly that would be devastating and be very concerning if that took place. And I only take an instance where, say, a Russian plane was shot down or something of that ilk for it to escalate.
Well, talking about escalating, it appears Dan Tehan, Liberal front bencher, went off to the US and came back convinced that we need small nuclear reactors and the like in Australia, and that the coalition are about to sign on. Were you surprised? I thought it had been dealt with at the last election.
Well, it's not been dealt with in the coalition party room. So there's two outstanding policy debates that are sitting there. One is the nuclear power, whether they're going to continue to advocate for that and promise it for Australia. And two, They haven't finalized their position on net zero. Now, they're of course interlinked. So last time round, Dutton used nuclear power as their plan to get to net zero. And we're seeing a lot of MPs push back against net zero. But ironically, there's been some of them that both don't like net zero but like nuclear power, which is kind of interesting. And Matt Canavan is one of those examples. So Tegan arrives, he's a prominent frontbencher in the coalition back from the US and says, we've got to do this. So that's a bit of a shot across the bow, just as we looked last week at Andrew Hastie's shot across the bow. We're getting a lot of coalition spokespeople, frontbenchers, freelancing at the moment, just talking about what they think. Is that a sign of healthy policy debate, or is it a sign that Suzanne Ley, their leader, doesn't really have a firm rein on her own MPs?
It's quite interesting because there are sort of diametrically opposed opinions running about this nuclear and how easy it is. John Quiggin, an academic who writes regularly on this topic, has sort of debunked the whole question in a paper called "Paper Reactors and Paper Tigers," which was in the Mandarin recently and is on his Substack page. Fascinating to read the debate. You have a sense of where the coalition might go with it?
Ironically, they're probably going to land a bit similar to where they did last time. I expect that they'll probably retain net zero in some form. Andrew Hastie kind of admitted as much. He said, I'm opposed to net zero, but I think I'm in the minority and I'm probably going to lose my front bench position because of it. I don't think he'd say that if he thought he was genuinely in the majority. And it might be that endorsing nuclear power again is the only way for those that favour net zero to continue having it as a policy position. So they could end up exactly where they were last time, Michael.
Staying with domestic politics, we've got the 5% federal government Albanese housing purchase policy kicking in. Mixed reactions from the population generally. People saying this is just going to drive prices up and it's all going to go crazy. Others saying this is helpful to let kids who can't get into the market get into the market. What do you think about it all? Is it good domestic politics or is it just too populist?
I think it's populist. I think it's a sweetener that they offered people at the last election. Most housing analysts think that it's going to do one thing, and that's push house prices up. So it's all very well to say people you need to save up less money to buy a house. That sounds good. But if those housing prices keep going up, then you're still paying more. And in fact, the banks will like it because you're paying more for the house and you'll end up with higher interest rate payments over time.
And lots of mortgages in that sector of the banking. But still, I guess one way or the other, people want houses. I mean, surely it's even if it's marginal, a good thing that some people can be encouraged to buy a house when they thought they'd never be able to get the deposit for it.
I'm just a bit skeptical, Michael, because if we've got more demand than supply and we just keep stimulating demand, that just makes houses more expensive. It doesn't really make houses more affordable. Let's say a house goes up $50,000 or $100,000 in an area that you're looking at within about 3 months of this policy coming in. Has it really made a house more affordable? I've got to question that. And if you look at a range of policies, going right back to the Howard government's first home buyers grant, they've tended to stimulate demand. Now, this government is trying to shift supply. The problem it's got is that supply is out of its domain largely. It can throw money at the problem, but houses are built by private operators, which are regulated by state governments
The
predominantly.
trouble is, if you're sitting around the cabinet room or you're the minister in charge, and you say, "Well, what can you do? What else can you do? Is there anything you can do? Do you just leave it as it is and hope that domestic economic conditions will change so that it all sorts itself out in the next 10 or 15 years?"
Well, the only long-term solution, and this is not doesn't sound that good for someone right now, but the only long-term solution is to build more houses. Because if you build more houses over time, housing prices either stay static or they might slightly decline, which is what where you want to be. The housing, I think what government should do is set a income to housing ratio that is their target. So I think it used to be about three times somewhat the median income was the median housing price. Now it's about 8 to 10, depending on the capital city that you're in. Well, that's clearly unsustainable. That's what they should be doing. That's your real housing affordability measure, in my view.
Martin, speaking about sustainable, can we turn to the US shutdown? I'm sort of becoming a person who does a deep yawn when I hear about that in the US. That is it going to close down the world economy? What effects are going to have in the US? Is it a boon for President Trump? Is it exactly what the Democrats needed to show that they still exist? But Martin, perhaps you can just tell our listeners briefly what the shutdown's about, and do you reckon it'll end? How? When?
Well, unfortunately, this is again a symptom of US politics, which is incredibly polarized, where the Democrats and Republicans can't agree on anything. Basically, what happens is Congress passes a budget each year that funds government. And we have the same system in Australia. You need money to run your government. So, and that's derived by Parliament. In the US, they agree to continue funding the most critical agencies of government, such as the FBI, CIA, and the Army, things like that. But they haggle over the funding for all of the other remaining parts, particularly around health and education. And so they haven't passed that budget, and accordingly, whole sections of the government are shutting down. And those employees won't get paid, although they can be back paid if they work across that period later. Though you can imagine, Michael, if you've got mortgages and all that sort of stuff, that's extremely worrying and distressing for those people. Trump, who has always believed in small governments, almost sees this as an opportunity to sack a few employees and trim down government. Unfortunately, there's something in this for both Republicans and Democrats. The Republicans want smaller government anyway, and they see this as showing that Democrats are obstinate and that they want to fund frivolous things. The Democrats have been knocked around a bit by the last election. They've lost control of the Senate and Congress, the House of Reps, and the presidency, and so they want to show their supporters they could fight. So fighting for them is a powerful yardstick at the moment. But the loser is the American people that's not getting the urgent services that they need.
Well, it's a crazy thing. As I say, I've just engaged in the long, sort of loud yawn when it comes to these topics. But Martin, we aren't a state of the US yet, and they can do what they like, I suppose. We'll eventually see the wash up, will we?
Eventually, there will be an agreement. There always is. There seems to be an agreement for some additional f defense spending for the Republicans. They still have their pet projects. They'll tell you they support smaller government, but they still have areas that they want extra money for. And the Democrats will get some concessions, I expect, in health and education. But one more final thing on this, Michael. The Republicans actually technically control the Senate, the House of Representatives, and the presidency. So, if they were actually able to line up all of their MPs, we shouldn't be in this position. But American politics are such that even individual MPs go their own way.
Well, as I say, you haven't stopped me yawning, Martin, I have to tell you. And the good thing is, perhaps we can finish with this. We're not far away from the first big sold-out test, Ashes test between Australia and the visiting English team, the MCC. Do they still call them the MCC? I think they do. In late November at Optus, although we don't use that word anymore, Martin. Do you think Optus is dead?
Oh, well, I think that this is going to be an extraordinary clash. It's always a lot of anticipation. You can say what you like about other rivalries for Australians and for the English. There's no bigger rivalry than the Ashes. And there's a lot of anticipation. And Perth is home to the first test, which is exciting. And it's not that far away. It's only next month now.
On that more optimistic note about the world, I've just stopped yawning. Look forward to seeing you next Friday, Martin.
Look forward to it.